Laser Zone. Seeking answers to age-old questions. Deciphering the world painted around you by the mainstream media. This is the Kev Baker Show. And now, here is your host, Kev Baker.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be around the world. A big, huge, warm welcome to this, the Kev Baker Show, for a very special, extended broadcast. And tonight, we're going to be covering the Paris attacks. And we're going to be joined by two of the world's leading researchers. We've lined up Mr. Christopher Everard, of course, a fellow host on the network here, and the one and only Max Egan is going to be joining us from Down Under. So this is going to be a very, very special broadcast and a very important broadcast. Now, before I get going tonight, let me just tell you that in London, we are undergoing some kind of bomb scare right now. Baker Street tube station has been evacuated and an explosion has been heard. Russia Today are reporting on this story right now, and we will try and keep you up to date with anything that occurs. But bear in mind, the slamming of a door right now is enough to trigger one of these scares. And that's because the mainstream media have painted such a picture in people's minds that they think there's a dirty Muslim waiting to blow themselves up around every corner. And that could be nothing further from the truth. So hopefully we'll be able to decipher what really occurred in Paris tonight. And I can't think of two better people to do it with. But before I get to our guests, let me first go to my co-host, Johnny Whistles. Long show tonight, but this has to be done, John, because this is the most important event that we have covered, because so much can come off the back of this. We had best be on our toes.
Oh, definitely, Kevin. It's great to have two distinguished guests like these two to go over that with. So this should be an amazing show tonight. I'm really looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And let me thank everyone in the Wookiee Cave, in the chat room, on the stream listening live, and to anyone who is tuning in the archive. Please share this show far and wide. So first of all, let me bring onto the show and introduce Mr. Max Egan. Max, of course, has been on the show before, and you can find his work at thecrowhouse.com. And he's also got another thing on the go right now called fullcircleproject.net. And hopefully, as the show goes on, we'll be able to hear more about that. So all the way down under, Mr. Max Egan, how you doing, man?
I'm good, brother. Thanks for asking me on the show again, Kev. Always a pleasure to come and talk to you, brother.
Thank you so much for agreeing to share your time with us here today. And before I go to our other guest, Max, I have to ask you, because since telling people you were coming on the show, I've been inundated with messages to find out how you're actually doing, because you were the victim of a pretty ugly, cowardly attack just recently. So how are you doing, Max? Because the last time I spoke to you, it was just the aftermath of that.
Oh, look, I'm a lot better now. I mean, the ribs are still pretty sore and the shoulders are still pretty sore, but, you know, I'm up and about and it's all good. I mean, I still have a little bit of trouble sleeping and stuff like that. It takes a long time for bones to heal. But, you know, it could have been a lot worse than what I got. I'm kind of fortunate in a way. But it's just strengthened my resolve, Kev. It just makes me believe I'm on the right track, you know, and I'll just speak louder from now, and I'll just be a little more careful when I'm walking around in the dark, you know.
Absolutely, and just with all the mails I've had, there are a lot of people who are sending their love and thoughts to you right now, Max. So then, let's go over to our fellow host on the network and the man behind EnigmaTV.com, Mr. Christopher Everard. You barely need an introduction to this show, Chris, but welcome back. Long, long, long overdue.
Hello, it's very, very nice to be with you chaps again.
I just wish it could be under better circumstances. And before we even get going, let me just state right here, right now, that TFR, the Kev Baker Show, and everyone involved in this broadcast, we pass on our thoughts and prayers to all the victims and everyone involved in this. And we mean no disrespect by covering this when things are still fresh in people's minds. Chris, it's how we're to begin. I know you've made out some bullet points, but what an event. This is a game changer.
It is. It's an international game changer, like you say, because we've seen, we're 6 days away from those events, and we've seen in the last 6 days the government's kind of pulling rank, and there's been opinion polls published in the tabloid media in Britain and also in the USA asking people, do you think there should be an increase in bombing of Syria after these attacks? And of course, you know, we've seen, you know, the public saying, yes, let's bomb. Now, I lived in Paris for an entire year, in 1986 to 1987. And then I lived in Paris for almost another year, working for Radio Monte Carlo, back in the 1990s. So I know Paris pretty good. I have to say that, I haven't been to the Stadium of France, and I haven't been to the little area where the first attacks took place, which is Le Petit Cambodge, Cambodian restaurant, and Le Carillon. But the rest of the areas that are involved in this attack, I do know them. I've had French girlfriends. I have many, many French friends. It's a real shocker. It's a shocker for us. But I have to say that's even more of a shock for French people. French people, I have to say this, they live within the French-speaking world, which is a relatively small bubble. The French news on French TV does not cover world events like we see on our TV. It's almost as if the whole world does not exist apart from the small pocket areas that speak French.
So, okay. Sorry folks, MI5 are playing their games. Chris, you were going to lay out your bullet points.
I thought that in this first segment of the show, what we could do is we just lay out some of the topics, because let's face it, the mainstream media have been kind of playing a kind of chase your tail kind of situation with the viewing public and the listening public. So the first thing I would like to say is that there has not been a follow-up clarification of who it was exactly who told the authorities that these atrocities on Friday the 13th were perpetrated by so-called ISIS. If you analyze the news feeds in the last 6 days, they have said, oh, it's been claimed by ISIS. On the BBC, there has been no backup clarification of that whatsoever. Was it a tweet? Was it an email? Was it a text message? So that's the first thing. If you guys, you know, have heard a backup clarification, then I'd like to hear it. Second thing is, Anonymous have stepped in. Anonymous have said that they have successfully hacked and deleted around, roughly, about 1,000 Twitter accounts, which are all operated, so they say, by ISIS. Which, you know, I mean, I think that's a noble effort. But it leads us to the question, if Anonymous, who are an independent group, can isolate or identify those Twitter accounts which are actually operated by ISIS, then how comes Twitter didn't do that themselves? And that leads us on to YouTube. YouTube this week, I don't know whether you guys have seen this footage, but YouTube is just running alive with homemade footage. It's come from, you know, people's phones. And this is being filmed by gunmen in Syria. And this footage is showing people actually being killed and having their heads blown out and seeing their brains being blown out. And that footage, I mean, I scan it regularly. Obviously, I'm interested in covering subjects like Syria. And this last 6 days since the Friday the 13th massacre, YouTube is running alive with this stuff. You can see every kind of murder in Syria live almost. Now, it's ISIS, apparently, who are uploading this stuff. How comes Google, who are meant to, according to Ed Snowden, be in with this quite sophisticated monitoring program, I think it's called, is it called Paradigm or something? But how comes ISIS are able to upload on YouTube? Now, remember, just a little while ago, Amazon were actually selling Dabiq, which is the ISIS magazine. It'd been sold and distributed and marketed on Amazon for quite a long time, several months, before Amazon just found out about it. Were you guys aware of that?
I'm aware of Dabiq, but I wasn't actually aware of who was publishing it, where you could get it. It's always struck me, though, Chris, how these guys on the run in the desert are able to put together such a glossy publication and always manage to have the Hollywood cameras that not even you can afford, Chris.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And also uploading all of this footage, you know, when they're in gunfire fights in Syria. It's quite amazing. Okay, now let's get down to brass tacks. We had the Charlie Hebdo massacre, all right, earlier this year. And what we can see clearly and what logic tells us is that that was an inside job. And what I mean by that is that the gunman knew that the meeting with the senior cartoonists was happening at that time in that particular office on that particular day. Now, I own magazines and I've run magazines for many, many years. And I can tell you now, cartoonists mostly work from home. They're mostly freelancers. And Charlie Hebdo themselves admitted that they only had meetings like this, which was a big round table with all of the senior people present in one room, once a week or once every couple of weeks. So how did the gunman know when to strike? Now, an additional complication to Charlie Hebdo has now arisen since yesterday morning, because there's been a siege, there's been a gun battle in Paris. They were in the Saint-Denis area, which I know very, very well. It's towards the kind of northeast of the inner ring of Paris. And we now are being told by the BBC that the guy that masterminded the Friday the 13th massacre is also suspected of actually being the mastermind behind the Charlie Hebdo attacks as well.
And the guy behind the Paris to Amsterdam train attack, which just happened to have two off-duty soldiers on it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, that's right. Now, the interesting thing is that we've had a firefight in Paris, in Saint-Denis. You know, obviously, being a ringleader, this guy is full of information, but the BBC are now telling us he's dead. I want to say to the listeners, and I want to say to the general public, and especially all the new people that have stumbled in on the broadcasts, and you've done a great job, Kev, really, seriously, is that we have had several ISIS leaders being announced as having been killed several times. And then all of a sudden they pop up again, and then they get arrested, and some of them have been killed two times over. So, you know, let's just, like, today's news, they're saying he's dead, okay? We don't know that for sure. And I think the golden rule in these types of operations and this type of tabloid news reporting is that you have to, you know, don't have a knee-jerk reaction to the news reporting, because, you know, it's not always 100% correct straight away. And also, we cannot be sure what is going on.
Oh, Chris, Paris, I used to be one of these fools that would rush out and shout false flag. But thanks to being on TFR and learning from the hosts here and the listeners out there, I just encourage people to put the shout out that something is going on. Catch as much footage and initial reaction as you can. But please, please don't have that knee-jerk reaction like you're saying there. And I've been guilty of it, guys. I hold my hands up totally.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, what I was going to say about the Charlie Hebdo attacks is that the Charlie Hebdo officers as a legitimate target, considering this is fundamental jihadist Muslim terrorism. From that point of view, from a jihadist point of view, Charlie Hebdo makes logical sense as being a target, because we know that there's been a long history of Charlie Hebdo not publishing just satirical cartoons which are poking fun. This is real insulting stuff to Islam.
Well, just an example, not even to Islam. The other day, the kind of tasteful material, distasteful material they put out, Chris.
It's incredible.
They showed an image of the downed Russian jet.
Yes, I know, and they made it look like there was a missile going into its anus or something,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, there was a couple of them, and one was...
It's not even funny.
No, the danger of low-cost Russian flights and Russia steps up its airstrikes. Disgusting.
It is, and also, I don't know whether you noticed on that front cover there, Kev, you know, I know it's difficult because it's in French, but, you know, there's a lot of double entendre in French, you know, there's words, wordplay is a very French thing. They love it. You know, if you can inject a word which can twist and give a sentence a double meaning, that's a very French thing. They love it. And in that, on that Charlie Hebdo front cover with the Russian airliner, it was, insinuating that, Sharm el Sheikh was a sex trap, like a honeypot sex trap, for Russians. And it was like a cheapo, sex trap. I mean, it's so dirty to suggest this type of thing. Obviously, you know, Sharm el Sheikh, I can tell everybody now, it's a wonderful, incredible place. All those tropical fish that you see in tropical fish shops, most of that comes from Sharm. Most of those fish come from Sharm el Sheikh. When you go swimming there, it is like swimming in heaven. It's a very family orientated place. The Islamic people in those hotels, and I have to say, in all the hotels I stay in Egypt, are fantastically compassionate, friendly, lovely people. You know, this Charlie Hebdo magazine is just, I just don't agree with it. But if we put ourselves in the shoes of a jihadist, of somebody who's fanatical, somebody who is a typical character, which is painted by a tabloid newspaper like The Sun, then, yeah, you can say Charlie Hebdo as a target. You can understand the logic of a fundamentalist being enraged enough that they're going to actually take weapons and they're going to attack. Friday the 13th, what targets do we see? We see a Cambodian restaurant. Opposite there, a hotel bar, very run down. It was known as a dive bar. The only reason that bar ever got any trade is because the drinks were underpriced slightly according to that area of Paris. And the Cambodian restaurant, Le Petit Cambodge, means the small Cambodian, and the Le Carillon. This is kind of Paris. It's been dressed up as being central Paris. It's quite close to the center, but it's not what I would call, you know, the real famous, you know, it's not right next to all of the famous tourist areas. The next target was a pizzeria called Casa Nostra, which is wordplay on Cosa Nostra, which is the Italian term for the mafia. So there you've got three restaurants. There was a laundromat that was shot to pieces. And then you had a hostage-taking scenario so we're told, at a cafe theatre. A cafe theatre. So you've got a Cambodian restaurant, a hotel bar, a pizzeria, a laundromat, and a cafe theatre. Just literally less than 3 minutes drive, they could have hit proper government targets. They, if they're going to explode themselves, they could have exploded.
Chris, can I ask you, because I've been to London, I've never been to Paris. Is it like London in the centre? Is it like a ring of steel? Would it be deemed an easier target, what they chose, as opposed to going in for that real good spectacular?
Yes, I would say there is nothing in Paris that is similar to the Ring of Steel in the City of London. The City of London, with all those roadblocks where you know, every vehicle is photographed going in and going out. You know, France is not like that. Yes, there is security. Georges Pompidou Center, the Louvre with those crystal pyramids, the Elysee Palace, the very top end of the Champs-Élysées. Yeah, there's military at the Gare du Nord, which is the big railway station that handles the trains coming in from Normandy, Brittany, and all of the northern states in France. Gare Austerlitz is the big station that takes all of the trains going to the southwest. And you get military, I'm talking about proper camouflage, kind of military units going around. There's top security in those places. But generally speaking, closed circuit TV cameras, they don't really exist that much outside of Paris. Yes, a lot of places have CCTV in Paris, but outside of Paris, it's virtually no cameras at all. It's only in recent years that even banks and post offices have had CCTV in France. I'd say within the last 5 years. It's quite liberal. It's a libertine, liberal, much more relaxed atmosphere.
Now, we've got a couple of minutes left before the break, Chris, and I want to bring Max on after the break. So are there any more really hard points you want to make now before the break?
What I was going to say is that those targets do not make logical sense from a jihadist point of view. The other thing I would like to say is, who funds terrorism? I've been doing a lot of research in the last 6 days about how Boko Haram, how Al-Qaeda and ISIS have been getting money. And one of the biggest paymasters, if not the biggest paymaster, is President Hollande. The other thing I'd like to cover later on in this show is the Afghan warlords, because this is all tied up with the Mujahideen, the ISIS, Al-Qaeda. This is all interrelated. And I'd like to say that the Afghan warlords, who are, in kind of cahoots with Her Majesty's forces guarding the opium fields, they have dancing boys and whole harems of underage boys. And there's opium, there's hashish, there's a drug business that's linked to this entire jihadist movement, even though, smoking is not allowed. And other things I'd like to cover is that Turkey is being fast-tracked by Angela Merkel to be a member of Europe, which means that the Turkey to Syria border will become the European border. And of course, the Turkey to Iraq border will become the European border.
And just during the week there, Chris, we had a soccer game cancelled over in Germany because of a bomb scare, an alleged ambulance truck dressed up as a bomb. And at the same time as that was going on, down in Turkey, they were actually chanting Allahu Akbar during the national anthems and the minute of silence for the actual game, the actual events that took place. So that gives you a taste of what's happening in Turkey right now, folks. We've had Mr. Everard. When we come back from the break, we'll be going live down under to Max Egan. Stay tuned, folks. We haven't even started.
You're listening to the True Frequency Radio Network.
No hate, no hype. No fear.
Welcome back, everyone, to tonight's very special broadcast of the Kev Baker Show in association with Down the Rabbit Hole and Truth Frequency Radio Network, where we offer you the very best of protection from deception. Now, tonight, We have waited, we've let the dust settle before we got two of the world's best researchers on to talk about this Paris affair. What the hell is going on, guys? And let's go down under to Mr. Max Egan of thecrowhouse.com to get his take. And Max, where do you start? I'll just let you begin where you want.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Where do you start? I mean, this has been wholly predictable. I actually said a few months ago we could expect to see a terror attack staged in France. And I really believe this has been staged. I really do. I think there's a higher agenda to all this. It's hard to call false flag on things, like you say. And I'm not going to speculate like many people are doing. A lot of people are saying, oh, hoax, no bodies, all this sort of stuff. You know, I'm in Australia. All I've got is video footage and pictures. I can't make calls on those sorts of things. You've got to be rational about all of this sort of stuff. There's certainly some of the video footage we've seen is extremely suspect. There's one that came out of a cameraman. Apparently he was a cameraman or a news reporter who was staying nearby and he was filming on his mobile phone. He was filming the alleyway and there was a woman hanging from a window. This woman appears to be hanging by a strap or something. I mean, this is virtually impossible for a woman to be doing this. I mean, this seems to be something that's been set up to sort of pull the heartstrings, that particular shot. Of course,
she's pregnant as well, Max.
She's pregnant, and you look at it, the lights are all on in the street. This was pointed out by a friend of mine, PK. The lights are all on in that street, except the light next to her is not on. So we can't see clearly whether there's a strap. And there's no way you could be hanging for like, this is like 2.5, nearly 3 minutes, a pregnant woman hanging from a ledge like that. A strong man couldn't do that. She must have been hanging by a strap. And of course the camera seems to be the cheapest possible phone camera you can get. So it's a very, very blurry image. So, you know, my cheap phone would get a better video.
Have you noticed, Max, there's a bit of a similarity in these events now, because I do believe that real people die. However, I believe there's staged stuff around the real event. And this rooftop footage now seems to be the thing. Charlie Hebdo, rooftop footage. Everything's shot from rooftops or up high from an angle. And I'm starting to think that that's the stuff we really need to analyse if we're going to look into that.
Yeah, and it's also always shot on phones that are the cheapest possible video quality you can get. You notice that. They're always very, very blurry images. Now, you can get a $100 mobile phone now that'll do crystal clear video. So why are these people all using these really cheap plastic lenses, blurry images always? And it's always a debatable thing about what's going on. You can't really see what's going on with that woman. So this has been set up, and there's certain things to look at. You know, you look at these events, and you go, okay, what are we going to see from this event? Are they going to find a passport nearby? Because this has become standard procedure, and of course they find a completely undamaged passport by a man who apparently blew himself up. Yeah, but the passport isn't even singed. It's in pristine condition. Then you look for drills. Are there any drills on the night? Of course, we find that there were drills running on the same night. And these sorts of things are always going, you know, like we see this in every event. We're seeing drills. We're seeing passports found. We're seeing blurry video footage, which is designed to whip up the heartstrings. And then we see a massive international response and we see a further push to escalate the war in the Middle East. Every time the war in the Middle East is flagging, then we see some of these events happen and we see a massive push to escalate the conflict in the Middle East. And okay, well, maybe I'm being conspiratorial about it and maybe none of it's the case and maybe it was done by ISIS members who are actually part of ISIS and they just want to go and blow up France. Okay, well, let's look at ISIS. It's clear, it's been shown, even stated by Putin the other day, that ISIS is receiving funding from 40 nations, many of them G20 nations. We already know that they're receiving funding and logistical support from the United States and from Israel and from many other countries. We know that they're selling their oil through the Kurds and through Turkey. So we know who ISIS is. Even if it was ISIS who carried out this attack, well, Western governments are ISIS. So this was carried out by Western governments, either way you look at it. Even if they are the ones who radicalized these young kids and got them to go and do whatever it is they do. I mean, it's very easy to get some young extremist kid who's come from a downtrodden background. He's got a chip on both shoulders. His life's been meant to be that way. He's been bred to be that way. And you can get him to march to whatever drum you want. But it's who's pulling the strings higher up. ISIS is a fully run Western operation. It has been from the ground up. You know, Obama wanted to go into Syria and he couldn't, so they created this covert army that they built up in Iraq and in Turkey and in other places around the area, and then they just pushed it all through. This is what was created out of the destruction of Libya, all the weapons that they pummeled and sent into Libya. Then these people just jumped straight across and started going through Syria. You've got ISIS driving around the desert there, driving. They've got like up to 30 working M1 Abrams tanks, US tanks. They've got US Humvees. They've got fleets of Toyotas. They've got AR-15s and M16 weaponry. They've got howitzers. They've got all sorts of weaponry that is all Western weaponry. They're documented to be receiving medical attention and logistical support in the Golan Heights, all funded by Israel. I mean, people need to wake up and see this for what it is.
Exactly, you know, Max. If there's new listeners out there, one way you can go and actually back up what Max is saying, go and find the photo of the mastermind, Abdelhamid Abaoud. Because in the main picture that they're showing you, he happens to be sitting in a brand new shiny Humvee. Now, there's got to be a problem with that.
That's the thing. They're all, look at the hardware these have got. These guys sprang onto the scene incredibly well funded, incredibly well equipped. You know, this just doesn't happen. You don't just get a terrorist sudden, you know, a terrorist organization or a ragtag bunch of militants that have suddenly so organized, got all of this support. And this is about escalating the conflict in the Middle East. And it's very significant that they use Paris, and it's very predictable that they would use Paris. As Chris pointed out, they used a Cambodian cafe. So let's get the Cambodians angry. If you wanted to raise the anger of the entire world against Islam, what's the best place you could stage an attack? Look at a city in Europe. Where could you really do it? I mean, Berlin wouldn't really work. There's too many people that have got a problem with the Germans because of World War II. You couldn't really do it in London. There's too many people that have got a problem with the Queen and the royal family and all this sort of stuff. But Paris, the city of love, everyone's favorite destination where millions upon millions of people have gone for their honeymoons, the Eiffel Tower, all this stuff. Everybody loves Paris. And it also gives the impression that these terrorists can attack us anywhere. And if you really want to get the anger of the world raised, then Paris is the perfect place to stage the attack. And not only that, but because Paris is part of the EU and there's also the Lisbon Treaty. And what the president of Paris, President Hollande, was very particular to do was to say that Paris, France is now at war. We are at war with ISIS. And the fact that that's a declaration of war is saying we're not going to say we're going to go and bomb Syria. He's saying we are at war with ISIS. ISIS is based in Syria, so we're going to go and bomb Syria. But by making that declaration of war, and by looking at this terrorist attack as an act of war by ISIS, he has invoked the Lisbon Treaty, which then puts all of Europe against ISIS, puts all of Europe at war, because that's part of the Lisbon Treaty.
Oh, wow,
now, if
Max,
one country is attacked, you know, if one country's attacked, everybody has to jump in and support them. You know what I'm saying? It's part of the Lisbon Treaty. So there's a very real danger that this could engulf all of Europe and obligate all of Europe to start going and bombing Syria and just escalate this conflict in the Middle East like to a ridiculous degree. There's a possibility that could happen from this.
You see, the language that he used really struck me, and I'm glad you've brought this up because I was wondering maybe if it could pull NATO into this. And he was very precise about saying that they were now in a state of war. And then hours after the French attacks, we had the French attacks on Raqqa, and then we had an ISIS attack or some kind of attack in Nigeria. Now, I was starting to think, well, if they're at war with a terrorist entity, does that now give them justification to go and bomb any country that ISIS may or may not be in?
Well, it does. It automatically invokes NATO by just simply saying we are now at war. France is at war. And he was very, very specific in saying that. And this has happened so quickly. This has happened so very quickly. And now we're saying France is at war. And suddenly we've got all of these migrants rampaging all the way through Europe and just overrunning Europe. So where does this put it? Are we going to see civil war breaking out on the streets of Europe? Is this going to give, if we are at war, does that then give every country in Europe the ability to impose martial law in their countries to deal with this terrible Muslim menace that has infiltrated into Europe, you know, which is the way they're going to play it? You know, and there is no terrible Muslim menace. I mean, half of the people that are coming in with these refugees aren't even Syrian. These are people from all through Africa and Sudan and everything with fake Syrian passports, just like Gaddafi said would happen. You know, the prophecy of Gaddafi, he said, if you take out Libya, you know, we are the catching mitt. We are the basket that catches all of the refugees that come up through Africa. If you take out Syria, then you are going to see Europe overrun with African refugees within 5 years. Something like that, he said. And we've seen it. We've seen it happen. And it's all been planned. It's all been played. So there's a real possibility that this is going to get very, very ugly in Europe. And just through that statement of declaring this an act of war, this gives the ability for all of Europe to be basically locked down into martial law if they want to play it that way. And it gives them an excuse to escalate the conflict in the Middle East. And people have to look at what this war on terror really is. I mean, the war on terror is a war of terror that's been waged by all of our governments. I said back in my first film in 2008, The Big Picture, I said that World War III has already started because World War III is a war that has been waged by the elite against the people of the world. And that's what this is. The war on terror has been fought on two fronts. On the ground, it's a war for Greater Israel, which is all of the Middle Eastern countries that are being destabilized. This is all within the map of Greater Israel. It's also a war to support the Kalergi plan, which is to completely destabilize Europe and turn it all into one race in Europe. I mean, that's a whole show to go through the Kalergi plan. I recommend people go and read that. People will look at that plan and say, this is about the, it's about white genocide. It's about the destruction of the white races, but really it's about the destruction of all races by merging them together. Turn all of Europe into a basket case and then just leave it for 100 years and see what you get. You know, everyone will have bred together and merged together and it'll be a completely different landscape to what it is now. That's all part of the Kalergi plan. That's the two fronts that it's been waged on the ground. But the other front that it's been waged is the war that is being waged against the people of all nations via the removal of their rights that this so-called war on terror is providing the governments the ability to do. And we've got to call this out. You know, we've got a criminal cabal that's running this planet, and the same people that are taking all of our rights away under the guise of protecting us are the same people who have created this whole terrorist mayhem and who are waging all of this through their proxies. I mean, even when you look at us, it's all of their funding is coming through Saudi Arabia, which is fully funded by the United States and support. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Israel are virtually joined at the hip. So, you know, we've got to really step back and look at this. Like I said, even if this was Islamic jihadists, as they keep telling us, they're very careful to put the word jihadist, Islamist, in every second sentence. When these guys are about as Islamic as Mickey Mouse, you know, these guys are like Iran says, they're just Daesh. They're just mercenary terrorist scumbags. I mean, they're not Islamists at all. They're attacking every Islamic nation on earth, and they're not attacking Israel, which is supposed to be the sworn enemy of Islam. There's a pipeline that runs from Iraq to Israel right through the middle of Syria. ISIS are driving around that. They haven't blown that up. You know, like, come on, you know, we've got to call this. And I can't help but look back at Netanyahu a year ago when France recognized the Palestinian state. He said, things are going to go very bad. France has made a grave mistake by recognizing Palestine as a state. And then a week later, we have the Charlie Hebdo attack, and now we have this. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, all eyes have to point towards the groups that are actually financing and creating this so-called terrorist organization, which is the West, you know. And even saying what I say about Israel, I mean, Israel's a puppet state. It's just an attack dog. It's run by the bankers anyway. There's a banking cartel that's running this whole thing. It's about redrawing the entire world map. That's what they're doing.
And this cartel are doing that by use of the Hegelian dialectic. Now, most people are used to hearing problem, reaction, solution. But with the size and the magnitude and the consequences that could come of this, Max, we're looking at Paris reaction solution, because people right now, they're absolutely ready to lie down and give up all of their rights under the guise of security from the same people who are funding the guys who are allegedly coming to get us. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. It's a play, Hegelian dialectic, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and then the new synthesis becomes a thesis for the next step, and that's the way they've been playing it all along. It's a tried and true method. They've been running things this way ever since Nero burnt Rome and probably before. You know, it's a tried and true method and it works every time. You know, when you look at this and you look at how it's been played and you look at the clues that they leave around, like I said, the passports, the drills, there's always one video that's designed to really, really pull the heartstrings. And then there's an immediate play for more security, more loss of rights. and a further increase in military action in the Middle East. This is the result of every one of these so-called terror attacks. I mean, ISIS have been bombed by Russia in Syria at the moment. They've been bombed by everybody. Well, are they not getting enough? They need to get some more people involved in bombing them. You know, whoever carried out this attack and dropped a Syrian passport and yelled out, "This is for Syria," was someone who wanted the whole world to rally and go and bomb Syria and escalate the conflict in the Middle East. And that should be obvious to anybody who's looking at this with open eyes. It really should. You know, we're being played. And sure, I do think people died, but I think there was a certain amount of things that were staged in it as well. But, you know, they're going to kill people. Of course they are. There's no point faking all of that. You can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs, and it's a lot easier to kill a few people than to fake.
These are the
it,
people that brought down the Twin Towers. They're not exactly afraid to go and kill real people.
Yeah, it isn't like they're trying to carry out these terror attacks and save lives in doing so, you know.
And what do you make of the outpouring of grief on things like Facebook, Max, when we see everyone putting the tricolour over their profile pictures, yet throughout the world, every day, there's people dying, there's people oppressed. What does that say about us as a society?
Well, it says a lot, really. But it also, I mean, this is a play. You've got to understand the government will do this. Facebook will do this to see who's buying into the myth, what people's political views are. This is a great way of profiling people and mapping the human terrain. You know, see actually who put the colours on, who's buying into the story and who isn't. You know, so that's why they do that. I mean, the media plays it and they cause people to do this, and we see such an outpouring. We see all the governments organizing all this. I mean, within a few hours, they had the Sydney Opera House in French flag colors. I mean, this has got to be already, it takes them a while to set this up, you know?
Yeah.
Everything, the whole world was in French colors within a matter of hours, you know?
Yeah. So it's good that they have those bulbs, isn't it?
It is. They just had them all there handy. I think what they do, Chris, is on all these organizations, they've got thousands of bulbs set up. So whatever country there's a terrorist attack, they're ready to go to their flag within a matter of seconds.
I just got to go and select
the preset for that country, you know, whatever it is. But, I mean, you see all this, they play on the heartstrings to push this onto the people. And then they say, okay, well, who's going to do it? Who's buying into it? And that's what that Facebook meme is about. Okay. These guys, they actually believe that this was a terrorist attack and we need to stand in solidarity with France. So, okay, we're good to go with this war. We've got a good response. You know, you look at the who's done it and who hasn't. Okay, well, the majority has, so we're good to go. You know, this is the way they measure things, mate. All these things are social profiling and mapping the human terrain. That's what it's all about. That's what the whole digital thing's about. That's what Facebook's about. That's what your mobile phone's about. That's why they collect all the data. That's why everything. And they collect all data, every text, every email, every phone call, every post you make, all of it, and they correlate the whole lot, and they use it to map the human terrain. All your search engine stuff, it's not just what you're searching about, it's what you're thinking about, and they want to know what the world is thinking about so they know how to play things. That's what it's about, mapping the human terrain, all of this stuff.
And all of these bad guys, these terrorists who are drawn to the death cult over there and do return back here, you have to think out there, guys, how come the intelligence services know such an accurate number of how many they are? And how is it always in the aftermath that we find out that they were already on lists? Some of them even stopped after the attacks.
They're unreal, mate. They're unreal. There'll be a terror attack, and they'll give you, within a day or a couple of days, they'll give you a whole social profile. This guy was born here. He was associated with these guys. He was radicalized on this date. You know, they know all this, like, they've got this incredible stuff. I mean, you're serious? You actually know when he was radicalized and by who and all this sort of stuff and what groups he was carrying? I mean, how do you know all this stuff so quickly? It's a joke. It's
their own narrative actually exposes the full agenda if people would just actually think for themselves. And that's the problem nowadays, Max, because people don't think for themselves via the mainstream. They're told what to think, even when the images that they see are contrary to what they're being told.
Yeah, that's the problem, you know, and they just accept everything the media feeds them. They think the media is this all-powerful thing that can suddenly get all of this information to them, like instantly, like within seconds they're telling you what's going on, or minutes or hours. Like, well, 9/11, within minutes they were mentioning Osama bin Laden, and within a few hours they knew that it was him and his terrorist network, you know. I mean, how do they know all this stuff so quickly? It's ridiculous, you know. It's absolutely ridiculous. they just put up all these social profiles and all this stuff to make you think and make give you the concept that the government is all powerful and the media is all knowing that you're getting the truth and it's all good. We've got you back. You know, it's a scam.
Well, they've got us where they want us, or the majority of us, Max. People are running about in fear when firecrackers go off in the streets, cars backfire, there's people taking cover. What do you think we might see next? Do you expect this wave to carry on?
Look, I do. I wouldn't be surprised if they stage another attack in Paris. I mean, what we've just seen in London may well serve to do that, though. I mean, I think we're going to see this go really, really global. I mean, even here in Australia, they're talking about a need to reintroduce the death penalty in Australia for suspected terrorists. And police have been given the ability to shoot to kill any suspected terrorist, okay? A suspected terrorist. They're given the ability to shoot first and ask questions later. That's all it is. You just got to be suspected. Someone's just got to say, I'm sus on that guy over there. They'll just go and shoot you and then see if you had a bomb. It gives them the ability to do that, you know. So this is what we're seeing from this, and we're going to see a huge, huge ramping up of this. But I fully would not be surprised if there's another attack in Paris or somewhere else in Europe. It wouldn't surprise me at all. But again, that could be what we've seen in London. It'll be interesting to see how they play this out. Of course, they'll tie it into Paris, you know, they will.
Absolutely. And of course, we've got the world's media based in Paris right now, cells emerging all the time. And we've got the Europe's most wanted man, Salah Abdeslam. And right now, the mainstream media are saying that the search has been extended into Holland, again, heightening the fear across Europe. And you know, Max, you're down under, but I fear that if there is an attack in Germany right now, that could be enough to spark some civil unrest, because we've seen thousands taking to the streets in protest at the immigration that is happening. Now, we're told of millions coming into Germany, Merkel's welcoming them. And the German people are not happy. And unfortunately, this has seen a rise in the right. And I really do fear, if they pull something off in Germany, that could be the big one.
Well, it could be. You could be right there. You know, one more in Europe, and we're going to see a complete mess. But I think, I mean, that's the plan. You know, the plan is to watch Europe burn. You know, and if you look at the Kalergi plan, you see it all outlined in there. And that is the plan. So people need to pay attention. But it's not the immigrants that are coming in and doing this. The immigrants have been brought in there, I believe, to create an environment and create an area and a feeling where there's going to be civil war. You know, you got to get all the people in there, get all the combatants in there. And if they're not combatants, we'll turn them into the combatants by just vilifying them, staging attacks so that suddenly everybody hates all the migrants that have come in. And things will just take their natural course. There's a lot of innocent people that have come in that are desperately looking for somewhere to live. A lot of them don't even want to be there. A lot of them would prefer to go to Syria and go back to Syria. And there was talk that there was going to be like 1 million migrants returned to Syria now that Russia had gone in and cleared out a lot of the bad guys from Syria. But of course, now there's a huge bombing campaign escalated. Everybody wants to go and bomb Syria now. So you're not going to see any of these refugees returning. So it's almost like it's a chess game. You know, Russia came in and kind of circumvented them for a little bit, but now they've rallied the world to go in and give their pet terrorist army air support. And, you know, declaring war against ISIS, well, you're declaring war against anybody you think may have those leanings, which could be anybody in Europe. And war against ISIS is not Syria. There's no point in bombing Syria. Syria is also at war against ISIS. And Syria is being decimated, so, you know, it's not the way to play it, you know.
Well, you and Kev were speaking about what may be the next big thing to come out. Quite a lot of the stories on the news just now is the fact that ISIS maybe have their hands on quite a lot of chemical weapons. Do you think that would be used in Europe? Do you think that could be something to look at?
Look, it wouldn't surprise me at all. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, that would probably be a great thing for the powers that believe they'd be. I mean, a chemical attack, that's going to put everybody in all sorts of fear. And that's what the game is. The name of the game is fear. So it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, anything's possible. anything's possible. You know, we've got to really look at, like I said, look at what ISIS is and who's funding ISIS. And I would say ISIS is Israeli secret intelligence services. I really would. So, you know, we've got to look at it and we've got to call it out for what it is. It isn't just these radical people on the ground, or even if it is, we've got to look at who radicalized them, where the funding comes from, and how the group was created to begin with. You know, it's just another pet terrorist group that's been created by the West. We've created a lot of them. We created Al-Qaeda, we created Al-Nusra, we created ISIS, and it's all the same people. There are no moderate rebels. You know, you're pumping all this money and all these arms into the area. There are no moderate rebels. There's just rebels. And when you're creating these areas, you're going and bombing the hell out of Syria and you're getting these people completely destroyed. You've just bombed their house and blown up their family under the guise of protecting them from ISIS. And suddenly these people are starving. They've got nowhere to go. And you've got all these ISIS terrorist armies offering them a good wage to come and work for them. What do you think they're going to do?
Absolutely. You're tuned into the Kev Baker Show. We are still going to be live for another 2 hours. Join us after the break. Mr. Max Egan and Christopher Everard, myself, Kev Baker, and Johnny Whistles right here, www.truthfrequencyradio.com. Don't go anywhere.
Now tuned into the Truth Frequency.
We are TFR.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Down the Rabbit Hole. And it is not Popeye tonight, and I'd like to give a big shout-out to the man himself who had agreed to give us his 2 hours tonight for this very special broadcast in association with the Kev Baker Show. Now, for all the new listeners tuning in for Popeye's show, I'm Kev Baker. I'm joined by my co-host from KBS, Johnny Whistles, and we are joined by Mr. Christopher Everard from EnigmaTV.com, and Max Egan, all the way from down under in Brisbane, from thecrowhouse.com. Now, at the start of the show, I alerted people to a possible event that may have been unfolding down in London. And I want to go over now to Christopher Everard, who has been checking into that. So, Chris.
Oh, yep.
Feedback there. No, that's it. That's it.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely crystal clear.
Okay, just over an hour before we went on air, the Metropolitan Police closed down Baker Street. Baker Street is one of the big main roads. This really is the centre of London. It seems that there's been an entire clear out of the whole of Baker Street. There's a picture posted. This is on the mainstream newspapers. It's on the Metro London newspaper now. There's a hatchback car, which the police have deliberately exploded in a controlled explosion. They said it was a suspicious car. Now, you don't know whether this is a false flag, because a French man was found at Gatwick Airport on the Saturday following Friday the 13th. He had an air rifle and a knife, and the police were said by the BBC to have carried out and a controlled explosion at Gatwick Airport. You know, I mean, why? I mean, they exploded a knife and they exploded an air gun, did they? You know, maybe this is another, like Max was saying in the previous segment of the show, maybe this is just another, you know, kind of chapter rolling out where it's a kind of shock tactic, or maybe it's real. But I can tell you now, the Bakerloo line, which is the underground train system in London, runs through Baker Street. You've also got Madame Tussauds Waxwork Museum, which is millions and millions of visitors. There's other tourist sites right next to Baker Street Station. Millions of people pass through that particular area. I'm not even sure whether you're even allowed to park a car there.
And the thing is, Chris, I suspect we may see another few false alarms over the coming days, because David Cameron, he's trying to build a case to go and bomb Syria.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. There's been three polls in tabloid newspapers that have been touted by the BBC. And the most recent one, it was broadcast on BBC PM show, which goes out at drive time, you know, here in London. And basically, they were saying that there's a 60% jump in public support for the idea of bombing Syria. They interviewed Labour MPs, most of the Labour MPs were against it when it went to a vote a little while ago. It was only a few months ago. And five of these Labour MPs, according to the BBC, are all now saying that they support bombing Syria. You know, Max's summary, I couldn't have put things better than Max did in that earlier part of the show before the break.
And Chris, feel free to bring Max back in now as well, because we've done away with the presentations. We can go all over the map.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to come back to this whole situation which we're discussing now, and this whole scenario. And I always like to look at the root of all of these situations. And I've monitored, I've got TweetDeck, so I've got six people tweeting me from various parts of the world all the time. I mean, I have more than six, but I can look at six feeds at the same time. I've got the BBC London news, and also I speak French, so I've got all of the French news as well. I've been monitoring this for the last 6 days. I have not heard a single report that is verifying or giving more clarification to this just stated fact that the BBC just trumpeting out, that ISIS have claimed responsibility for the Friday the 13th massacre.
Now, there is another video that has allegedly appeared, but I'm on enough lists as it is, Chris, and I haven't gone to view it. But allegedly, there is now the voice of a known French ISIS commander. This is another mastermind that has been thrown into the picture. They do claim responsibility again. And in De Beek magazine, obviously, they claimed responsibility for downing the Russian liner. Whether they actually do these things, that's another question.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, I want more clarification than that. And in actual fact, I have a very, very big, major kind of question mark hanging over these so-called claims that are always broadcast by the BBC. Why do they not republish the tweet or the email or the voicemail or the recording or whatever it was that was meant to be the official channel that they trust to definitely be ISIS that is claiming responsibility for these atrocities? Why is it that we never hear or see that original communication? How can it be in any way compromising national security when they're saying, oh, yeah, you know, ISIS have claimed it? Okay, ISIS have claimed it. You know, I'd like to see the communication or hear the voicemail or see the email or the tweet or whatever it was that has triggered this enormous frenzy of international worldwide media all now saying it's ISIS.
And the media are kind of doing what we, well, chastise some of the alternative media for doing. They're having a, well, a knee-jerk reaction. They're coming out right away before there's any evidence, and they're blaming ISIS. And I'll bring in Max at this point, because Max, on top of what Chris was saying there, why don't people ever question the fact that when ISIS do put stuff out and we get to see it, it's always via the site intelligence agency, and it's always a glossy, high-definition production. Surely people must see there's a problem with that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's they just believe what the television tells them, unfortunately. They've come to trust their news reporters, and they believe that their news reporters are informed, and that's just what they do. I mean, there's a great quote by George Orwell who said that the people will believe what the media tells them they believe. And it's true. It's just true. I think it's the fluoride, Kev. I don't know. I mean, there's something. I don't know what's going on. I don't know why so many of us can see through it, but so many people just buy the official line. But they never offer any proof of any of these things. But again, even if it is ISIS, okay, it probably was ISIS, but who's ISIS? ISIS is our governments. ISIS is us. We are ISIS. You know, the Western governments are the ones who created and funded ISIS and who created this entire situation. So, yes, maybe it is ISIS. And maybe ISIS do want to destroy Europe, but who is running ISIS? ISIS is being run out of Wall Street. It's being run out of Brussels. It's being run out of London. It's being run out of Washington. It's being run out of Tel Aviv. It's been running out of Al Ankara. This is ISIS. This is who ISIS is. ISIS is the West's pet terrorist army. So yeah, it probably is ISIS carrying out all the attacks. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, on that point, Max, you're absolutely 1,000% correct. On that point, I would like to say that I must have roughly about 1,000 followers from France on my Facebook, and also, I don't know, probably 2,000 or 3,000 on my mailing list. They're all French residents, and, you know, they've been following my work for years and years and years. And there is absolute amazement from these French people when earlier this week I actually published a New York Times article that confirmed that President Francois Hollande paid approximately somewhere in the region of 25 to 30 million euros, which is a lot in dollars, is about 34 million dollars to Al Qaeda. And they did that to get 4 French nuclear power workers who were working at a uranium mine, I believe it was in Nigeria, to be returned. So it was a ransom. President Hollande, he did that, excuse me, the money was paid around 2013. Obama, the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI told President Hollande, don't pay that amount of money in hard cash, tax-free, to Al-Qaeda. President Hollande and also the foreign minister went on to TF1, which is, you know, the main channel in France, and they denied that they'd paid any money. They said that they'd done it through negotiation. What happened then is two French newspapers, Le Republic and Le Monde. Le Monde has got very, very good contacts, go back historically many decades, with the French Secret Service. French Secret Service got many, many different departments. DGSE, they were responsible for blowing up the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbour. Then you've got, literally, I know people think that this doesn't exist, but it really does exist. It's called the French Foreign Legion. They were very, very much involved in brutal beheadings of Moroccan people. And, you know, they actually militarized Algeria and Morocco as French colonies.
And, of course, this first female suicide bomber, Chris, allegedly is a Moroccan-French national.
Yes. Well, I've got something to say about those French Moroccans as well. But essentially, you know, it's just been blowing French people's minds. You know, they've had the psycho shock horror of the actual massacre of Charlie Hebdo. Just, you know, fast forward a few months, we've got Friday the 13th. Well, I mean, there is a symbolism there because Jacques de Molay, the former leader of the Knights Templar, he was burned as a warlock witch on an island in the middle of Paris, and all of those Templar arrests happened on a Friday the 13th. There's lots of other Friday the 13th related events. And the French have had the massacre of Charlie Hebdo, then they've had the Friday the 13th massacre, but then there's been this aftershock, and the aftershock has been coming through social media. I posted the New York Times article that confirmed that Francois Hollande had paid a huge amount of money. I think it's in the ballpark of $34 million to Al-Qaeda in Africa. I then posted, and that went bananas. That post was, you know, 500 shares easy in less than 12 hours. Then I posted Le Monde, and obviously that was in French, and La Republique. These two newspapers confirmed that money had been paid. And what Max was saying in the earlier segment, fleets of brand new Toyotas, Humvees. How much does a Humvee cost? Have you ever looked at the price of one of these things? They want £56,000 for a Humvee. These things are not cheap. The M16s, the AK-47s, the grenades, the bulletproof vests. Where is that money coming from? Well, you know, the shock to the French people, and some of them have not been able to actually even digest this information, because I had dozens of flashback kind of feedback messages coming to me through social media this week, all from French people, all in French, and I had to go onto the translator and write a standard reply to them, because they were so shocked that Francois Hollande had paid such a huge amount tax-free to the terrorists demanding a ransom in Africa. It does not stop there. Francois Hollande also paid 3.5 million euros to Boko Haram as well. Now, look at the situation, okay? I don't have concrete, you know, cast iron evidence that Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS are all interrelated, but I can tell you now, they will have some ideological shared platform, some ideology which unites them. And Francois Hollande has only been in power for a few years. He took over from Nicolas Sarkozy, and he has handed over the best part of 40 million euros. So I did a series of posts. They went like wildfire. I had dozens of messages coming to me back from French people. And this is an aftershock. Now, the mainstream media, they have very, very, you know, they haven't cross-referenced anything. In actual fact, cross-referencing in tabloid media, I mean, putting things into historical context, even, you know, going back, say, 2 years, they just don't do it. The only thing that they've been cross-referencing this to is Charlie Hebdo, and even then, it's just a cursory bit of coverage. Now, in terms of where exactly the masterminds and these gunmen grew up, where do they come from? I did a lot of research on Monday and Tuesday, and I found that there is a suburb of Paris. This is a teenage concrete wasteland with, you know, kids with their hoodies up, wearing handkerchiefs as masks. It's like the Wild West. Not all of them are Muslims, I have to say. Predominantly, yes, they are Muslim. No, they're not predominantly refugees. These are fourth, third, and second generation immigrants from the former French colonies. Most, you know, the most common ones are Morocco and Algeria, and there's some from Tunisia as well. Remember, we had this weird flash beach attack in Tunisia as well, which, you know, Tunisia, I mean, it's so tiny in comparison to Libya and Algeria, and the only thing it's got going for it is tourism, and now the tourist industry has been shattered in Tunisia. It was the only way of them earning foreign currency. It was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, if you remember, and the liberalization and the westernization of these pro-Islamic dictatorships. I mean, that's what we have to call them, let's face it, in the North Africa area and going up into the Levant region, bordering the eastern Mediterranean. And where did ISIS really come from? ISIS all of a sudden popped up out of nowhere when Arab people started waking up and started joining our pages on Facebook, started interacting with us with tweets. We had a fantastic show of solidarity, 7 million Christians in Egypt, and millions of Muslims holding hands, walking across all of the great bridges across the Nile. Cairo, remember, 25 million people, is the biggest city in Africa. 30 million people on the streets pushing out calmly the Muslim Brotherhood. Not only Muslims, but hand in hand with Christians as well. A fantastic show of solidarity. I'm proud to have played a major role in all of that. And up comes, out of nowhere, ISIS. All of a sudden, they're meant to have taken over the northern part of Iraq. Even that scenario, out of the blue, northern Iraq, if you just look at those areas, huge areas of northern Iraq were actually under the control of the British forces. And what were they doing? Sleeping?
And Chris, it's no coincidence that they really started rising and being talked about after the failed Syrian chemical attack.
And this is chemical attack, I have to say, Kev, and I was one of the journalists who broke the story that the fluoride, which is the base ingredient for those chemical weapons that were shipped to Syria, were manufactured in Britain by British firms, and they were given a nod and a wink and an export license by the British Department of Trade and Industry. And that's why I, in the trailer run-up for my show, I've got a funny cartoon voice saying, yeah, I've got a job in a chemical factory and making fluoride for Syria, because that is really what happened.
And that is exactly why they needed to change the game. No longer could they say the rebels were guys worth supporting. And Al-Qaeda, the kind of gloss had worn off them. Nobody was buying that anymore. And I'll bring Mr. Max Egan in at this point, because, Max, we spoke about the funding of this terror group ISIS. We're kind of talking about now where they came from. Earlier on in the show, we spoke about one bad guy being killed off in Bin Laden, and a new one pops up in Baghdadi. And that's very much like ISIS, because they've been about for many a year under many different names. And we can go back to the Mujahideen, where they first really popped up, wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah, they just keep repackaging the same thing. That's what it's all about. And looking at the funding that they get, and I mean, it's significant that they did spring up first. We heard of them was in northern Iraq. And you've got to look at what's going on in Iraq. It recently came to light probably about a year ago, or maybe a year and a half ago, that because the US is funding the Iraqi army, they're actually paying the wages of the Iraqi army. Because, of course, when you go into a country and destroy it, you need to pay the wages of the people in there. So they're paying the wages of the Iraqi army, and they realize that there's actually 50,000, at least 50,000 ghost soldiers on the payroll in the Iraqi army who are receiving payment from the United States, people who apparently don't exist. So you've got to ask where this funding is going from. Of course, in the same news report, we were told that they just found out there were at least 50 to 60,000 ISIL terrorists in the area. Okay, so we've got 50,000 ghost soldiers receiving funding from the United States. No one knows where Eric Prince and Blackwater or Z or whatever his latest invention is. No one knows where these people are. He did say he had a big job in the Middle East. He seems to have disappeared. Suddenly we have this huge band of mercenaries that spring up in northern Iraq. We have the United States funding 50,000 people that don't exist. We've also got Afghanistan, which they funneled, I think it was $103 or $104 billion into Afghanistan since 2003. They can only account for $38 billion of it. $38 billion out of $104 billion. So that is $66 billion that they cannot account for. So you're wondering where ISIS or ISIL or whatever they're called this week are getting all of their funding from and all of their hardware and all of this stuff. How can this terrorist group be have control of 30 US Abrams tanks? How do you do that? You can't really buy these on eBay. I think if I tried to buy a tank on eBay, there'd probably be a few eyebrows raised and there'd be and all the shipping cost as well. So, I mean,
just think about the seller fees.
You can't deliver that by a drone.
Exactly. So people need to really step back and look at this. There's been so many billions of dollars funded in there. How can they tell us that there's 50,000 ISIL terrorists in the area and 50,000 ghost soldiers in the area and not link it up? You're a news reporter, aren't you? Can you see a connection there? You know?
If you're wondering why if people are wondering out there why we're laughing, it's because this is so ridiculous.
It is. It's amazing.
It is. It's absurd. I mean, can you connect the dots at all, folks? I mean,
yeah.
For God's sake, you know. I mean,
I can give people a rundown.
Now,
right?
Chris, we're almost on the break, so I'm not going to let you start.
Break coming up.
Okay. So when we get onto the whole thing and look at it in northern Iraq as well, and you look at the plan for Greater Israel, it's all there, and you've actually got rich Israeli businessmen and magnates now buying land in ISIL-controlled territory in northern Iraq. Is that
real people, real radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR. The Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to tonight's very special broadcast right here on the Kev Baker Show, in conjunction with Down the Rabbit Hole. Popeye, unfortunately, can't be here with us tonight, but he really graciously agreed to give us these 2 hours. And we need them, because we have got Mr. Max Egan and Christopher Everard on tonight to break down the full picture around the Paris attacks. And during the break, we've been joined by my good friend and one of our fellow hosts here on the network, Mr. Joe Joseph. And it's great to have you on the show with us tonight, man.
Hey, buddy. Now, this is something that needs to be talked about, and I'm all ears. So don't let me disturb the flow.
No problem, Joe. And just during the break there, Max, we were discussing this whole funding and the money. And I would love you to run over some of the figures for the listeners out there.
Well, like I said, there's been, since this so-called war on terror started, there's been 100, yeah, they're wondering where ISIS is getting their funding from, right? There's been, like I said, I think before the break, did I mention before the break that there are 50,000 ghost soldiers on the US payroll who are receiving funding? Now, how much does a soldier get every week? This is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And this is where ISIS or ISIL suddenly sprang into being. And so that's an enormous amount of funding that's going into northern Iraq that's completely unaccounted for. But besides that, in Afghanistan, you have $104 billion have been funneled into Afghanistan since this war on terror started, and they can only account for $38 billion of it. So that is $66 billion that is missing from the coffers in Afghanistan. So you're wondering where they're getting all their equipment from. This is incredible, you know. This is $66 billion. And when people think of a billion, they don't really understand how much it is. They just think that's a big number. But like I recently released a film in 2008, and I did the figures in 2008, and in the 2008 timeline, a billion seconds ago from 2008 was 1959. A billion minutes ago was the time of Christ. A billion hours ago, nothing walked on the earth on 2 feet. Okay, that's how big a billion is. If you get $1 billion notes and lie them end to end, you can create a trail that goes all the way to the moon and around the moon and back and 2.5 times around the earth. That is a billion. It's a lot of money. And there is $66 billion that has gone missing in Afghanistan alone, not to mention the 50,000 ghost soldiers, which apparently are still being paid by the United States. They just happened to notice that, oh, they're there. They didn't say they were going to stop it. They just said, oh, we found out that there's 50,000 ghost soldiers on the payroll. And in the same news report, they tell us that there's 50,000 ISIL terrorists in the area. Of course, no one knows where Eric Prince is and Z or Blackwater or what the latest inception is. I mean, come on, folks. This is where they're getting their funding from. This is a mercenary army that's been put out there under the guise of being Islamic extremists. They're careful to call them Islamists and jihadists in every second breath, and all they're doing is attacking and destabilizing Muslim nations. And in the very same breath, you've got rich Israelis now buying land in northern Iraq in ISIL-held land. I mean,
yeah,
come on, folks.
It's just amazing. I mean, northern Iraq, I have to say, is traditionally, it's been occupied by the Kurds, and people don't understand that the Kurds are shoulder to shoulder with Israeli people. The Kurds are respected by the Jews, and there are, you know, Jewish people within within Kurdistan. But just on the point that Max has just been making there, we've had the situation with a guy called Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Okay, now this guy was killed in a bombing in 2003. But then the mainstream media said in 2004, now remember he'd been killed the year before, he was arrested in Fallujah. So obviously he hadn't been killed the year before. So he was arrested in Fallujah in 2004. And then the mainstream media made this guy pop up again, and he was arrested again in Bakuba in 2005. And yeah. Then they reported that he'd been evacuated from Iraq, okay? But then, in 2005, he was killed in fighting. But then, in 2006, CNN said he'd been killed again. That's one ISIS leader.
Chris, I've actually sussed it. I think his black pajamas were made out of the same material as the passports they used.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
And then there's a guy called, do you know about this guy called Abu Omar al-Baghdadi? Now, that's not the same guy as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. This is another guy. Abu Omar al-Baghdadi was captured. There was a big hoo-ha, you know, all press releases. We got him. We got him. This is 2007. They captured him 2007. They killed him. We got our guy. We got him. In 2009, CNN announced they'd arrested him. That's pretty good. That's 2 years after they're meant to have killed him.
Well, mate, we live in a world where Osama bin Laden can get younger and younger every video. So anything's possible, you know.
Yeah. Chris, what was the guy's name again?
This is Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. That's not the same guy as Abu Bakr.
That's not the same guy on my bowling team either, is it?
And then what happened, after this guy had been captured and killed, and then 2 years later, after he's meant to have been dead, he was arrested. Then he released video recordings, which were on CNN, which is pretty good going for a person who's meant to be dead.
Wow.
And then in 2010... he was reported killed again. Then you come to the Big Daddy. The Big Daddy is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
No relation of mine with a baker in his name, by the way.
That's a lot of daddies.
He was no relation. Get this. He was captured and he was detained. This is the official report from the Pentagon. They captured him in 2004. Between 2004 and 2009... he was a captured terrorist, and he was detained at Camp Booker. 2010, miraculously, even though he's meant to be in a detainee camp, he becomes the leader of ISIS. 2012, they say, we've captured him. Well, I thought they already captured this guy. They say, oh, we've captured him. 2014, CNN put out a rumor. Guys, we think he's dead.
Yeah.
And then at the end of 2014, they say, no, he's alive.
Now,
he's
changed his name,
and his name is now Khalif Ibrahim.
But how many lives does this – is he like a cat?
That's the thing, you know. And wasn't he identified by the president of Hungary as being Elliot Shimon anyway?
Yeah.
Identified as a Mossad operative. Wouldn't
that's
surprise
right, that's all. Right. Simon Elliott. Now, I've got a very interesting backstory to that. Somebody created a very clear photograph of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is now called Khalif Ibrahim. And they got a very clear picture of him standing behind John McCain when John McCain was involved in, you know, negotiations, whatever. You can say he was there, and this guy is standing behind John McCain.
Exactly. I've also got a picture of him. I've also got a picture of him wearing a gold watch, which is all very well for an Islamic fundamentalist, you know.
Yeah. Now, next to that, they had a photograph of Simon Elliott, Mossad agent, and put them side by side. It's very obviously that's the same guy. Now, that was a meme, and the meme, I don't know where, you know, you don't know where these memes come from, but it had already done the rounds when I saw it. It had been shared 900-something thousand times. There's a lot for a meme. Okay, nearly a million shares. I had a message all of a sudden, a friend of mine, they'd posted that and their Facebook account was put into that weird terminal mode where you had to then click and identify a selection of your friends to get back control of your Facebook timeline.
Yeah.
But they weren't showing the faces of the friends. They were showing, like, faces of their children, of babies. It was very difficult to identify. Well, they lost their Facebook account because they had shared that meme. Possibly, I don't know whether this could be the case, but I think maybe it is. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their Facebook timelines because they shared that meme.
And this is happening more and more now. And Max, I heard you wanting to jump in there.
Well, yeah, no, they've done that. I'm just saying they've done that with me. They've locked me out until I identified people. And the photos they were showing me, people tag themselves in all sorts of photos. They're showing me pictures of landscapes and saying, please identify your friends in this picture, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, right, this works, you know. And then you have three attempts and you can't do it, so you can't try again for 24 hours. So,
yeah,
it's a good one.
Yeah, I've had a one where I got a Facebook notification that says your post contains nudity. So that's weird. I've never posted anything, you know, with nudity. And so
I've had lots of them say this is a forbidden link, you know, and it's a news article about something really, really important. This has been identified as a forbidden link or, you know, a malicious link or something, you know. So they do that quite a lot. There's a real effort on social media to quell the spread of truth. There really is.
I tell you what, guys, it's going to get a whole lot worse because we've got the Snoopers Charter, and that will no doubt be added to in light of what's happened in Paris. And we can talk like this just now, Chris, but for how much longer?
Well, yeah, I think it's going to get very ugly very quickly. I really do.
Yeah. But
you're going to use this as an excuse to really, really start monitoring people and you're going to see people going to disappear.
Exactly. Exactly. Paris reaction solution. It can lead to so many things for the elites. Christopher Everard.
Yeah, I just want to say about the ghettos that have been set up in France and Belgium for, you know, these families that came from the French former colonies in North Africa. This is social engineering. This is exactly what Max has been saying in the first part of the show. Look at these gunmen who, you know, I mean, the official story from the BBC is that, you know, the larger majority of the people actively masterminding this were actually either French or Belgian. Yes, their families came from Algeria or their families came from Morocco. But essentially, these people are second or third or fourth generation Belgians and French. Now, I did a lot of research on Monday and Tuesday, you know, at the beginning of this week that's just gone. There is a suburb of Paris which is infamous. It's a no-go area. The French police haven't been in there for a very, very long time. The name of this place, it's called Cours Couronnes. It's in the northeast. It's a suburb. It's not that far from the center of Paris. It's a teenage concrete wasteland. It's been deliberately disadvantaged. There's been no investment in the housing. As I said, not everybody is a Muslim there, but nearly everybody is a Muslim. And I want to really just say this to the listeners, that there are hothouses, greenhouses of socially engineered ghetto slums in France and Belgium. And I believe that these have been deliberately socially engineered to provide a smokescreen for false flag terror attacks. I really believe that. The disadvantage relationship, when you, if you look at the statistics within these French ghettos, it's amazing. Unemployment is 14 times higher with these Muslim teenagers than teenagers which are literally living round the corner. And I have to say, after many, many years of living in France, my grandfather was French, is that what you see in posh department stores, in shopping malls, you very rarely see a non-white face dealing directly with customers. Where you see these people is you see them in low-paid jobs, flipping burgers, and this is a throwback to, I'd say, the late 1990s, the era of Sarkozy, and that was an attempted Americanization of the French economy and the French way of life. We all of a sudden saw from about 2003, 2004, 2005, McDonald's. France had McDonald's earlier than that, but they weren't prominently placed. We saw Kentucky Fried Chicken. We saw Starbucks. We saw these American firms all of a sudden setting up in French city centers, and that was literally the only place where you used to see non-white French people having a chance of even getting a job. Now, racism comes in many, many different forms. In the lower kind of formation of racism, racism comes from resentment. Resentment, jealousy boils over into racism, and then, as Hitler and all these other dictators know, the racism can be then stewed like a beef bourguignon and made to boil over into nationalism. And this is exactly what we've seen in these ghettos. These ghettos are not only in Paris. They're in Lille, which is close to the Belgian border. They're in Amiens, which is a very, very strange place. I filmed in Amiens. It's got one of the largest Gothic cathedrals. And those cathedrals, people watch my documentaries, they can see that they are really basically Kabbalistic, satanic kind temples. And Amiens erupted in 2005 with kids, Muslim kids, going on the rampage. And in a period of 20 nights in 2005, almost 10,000 cars were overturned and torched. 10,000 cars in 20 nights. There are millions of these disadvantaged children, and they went wild. And a national state of emergency, exactly like we have now with President Hollande at the Palace of Versailles, claiming, you know, that we're going to have 3 months of a state of emergency, was Jacques Chirac. Jacques Chirac also had to declare a state of emergency. Now, there is graffiti in Marseille. Marseille is on the southern Mediterranean coast. It's a really big city. It's, I don't know whether you guys have ever seen the movie The French Connection. There is graffiti everywhere. And I drove around there. I mean, it's not really a place you want to go to at night. It doesn't feel like France at all. It feels like you're driving around, I don't know, it feels like you're driving around Tangiers or somewhere in North Africa. Very few white faces around. It's great if you love couscous and if you know, want to go shopping in a kind of Turkish-style bazaar. But there's graffiti on the walls sprayed by, obviously, you know, indigenous white French people, and their questions. There's lots of graffiti which are questions, and one of them was, how comes there's more Moroccans living in France with no ID papers than there are Moroccans living in Morocco? And I'll tell you the answer, and I can answer it in one word.
Go for it.
Hashish.
Really?
Yeah. There is a road. It's the A9 motorway. It runs from the south near Marseille, and it runs right the way up through the heart of France, goes near Paris, veers off into Belgium, ends up in Amsterdam. And it's called the Hashish Highway.
And it's funny you should bring that up, because today, you know how they use these events, Joe, for any kind of political vehicle.
Yeah.
But one of the mainstreams, I believe it was the Daily Mail and Sky News, reporting on the fact that the mastermind, Abba Oud, he had been smoking cannabis in the days after the attack.
Well, hey, you know, that's
excellent. That was their headline. It was breaking news, and with the spy phone I've got, I even got that as an alert, Joe.
I think that's something that yeah, definitely requires a lot of people's attention. Come on. But in all honesty, you know, another thing, too, that I think they're trying to employ here, and forgive me if you guys have already addressed this, but we saw it starting, 2 years ago, maybe even more than that, really start to pick up speed here in the United States with the implementation of the Cloward-Piven strategy to go ahead and infiltrate the country with a bunch of migrants, you know, South Americans, Mexicans, Central Americans, with the express purpose of collapsing the social system and bringing, you know, that, and that's just one purpose. Of course, you have an open border down on that, and in Mexico, anything can get through. Now, I'm not an advocate for, you know, we're natives to the United States and we should not have immigration. I think that's bunk and it's baloney. However, what they're doing and what they have done in the United States, they did the same thing with Africans going over to Europe. This is all funded. This is all orchestrated. I mean, if you can't see that, I don't know, Kev. I think people have blinders on if they can't see it.
Absolutely. And Max, before the show, we were saying how they've weaponized the food, weaponized the weather, the water, and now they've weaponized groups of people.
Well, that's the way they do it. You know, the people that we're seeing infiltrating into Europe, all these migrants that are running all across Europe now, these people are the victims of globalism. As I said, Gaddafi predicted this would happen. If you take out Libya, you're going to stop any means of preventing a migrant flow into Europe, and Europe will be overrun in 5 years with African migrants. But these people are victims of globalism, and now they are being used as weapons for globalism. That's the way it goes, you know. It's very, very, clever the way they do this. But the people, you know, many of the people that are coming into Europe are victims who need help. These are people who've suffered incredible hardship and they need help. You know, but the way it's being done, just through the open border policy to just be able to let them come in free flow. There's some villages in Germany. There's a village I was reading, like 24 people, a very small village with 24 people that's got a castle on the outside of the village, and they've put 240 migrants in there. I mean, this is ridiculous. There's another village of 124 people or 125 people that has been told that they must accept 750 migrants into the village. This is absurd. This is completely absurd. This is no way to run any type of migrant program.
Wow.
But, you know, at the same time, what's the right answer as far as that's concerned? You know, because a lot of people will say, and I've said this too, wouldn't it be nice just to be able to travel anywhere you wanted to go without a passport? Just to be able to go and do your thing and travel freely, like, if you ask me, we're supposed to be able to do. And the problem is as soon as you do that, people say, oh, well, then you want the New World Order. No, that's not what I want. That's not what I want at all. I don't want the, quote, New World Order. But I do believe that the only way that we're going to overcome this is to evolve, not have a revolution and go complete circle back to the beginning again and start this process all over again as we have time and time throughout history, but to change the tact that we're on, to change the strategy, if you will. And I believe personally that the key to all of this is to doing away with money. You've got to do away with money somehow, some way. You got to do away with it and get people on the same page, because that seems to be what unhinges everything, is once greed enters the equation. And all of these people, like you say, are puppets. They're pawns for the powers that shouldn't be, to use to advance their agenda, to exact control over the human populace of the planet Earth. That's what we're seeing. You know, over in Saudi Arabia, they have those tents, you know, that they normally use for the Hajj, air-conditioned tents, just sitting there abandoned. No, nobody there. And it's a shame, because that can be put to use, you know. You don't necessarily have to bus people in everywhere. One of the things that I've always found, at least in my guesstimation, is instead of bombing the crap out of people, how about going and building schools and hospitals and things like that for them, and infrastructure, much like Gaddafi did with Libya. He built up the infrastructure and the people loved him. Now, the guy wasn't a saint, don't get me wrong, but things were a lot better in Libya when Gaddafi was there than now with Gaddafi not there. You know, Kev?
I'm actually playing catch-up here, Joe. I was away taking some much-needed toilet time before I made a puddle here.
Yes, no. And
but, you know, we've been talking about a lot of this, guys, and, you know, there is a way out of this, and I want people to stay tuned to the very last segment, because Max does have a way out of this. There is a way we can go after this cabal, and it centres around Palestine. So please stay tuned for the very last section, and we'll go over that. But Joe, we've still got an hour to go. Coming up after this, we've got the Rundown Live with Mike and Tristan.
Yes.
And right now they are having a mercha drive. Stay tuned to find out more about that from Big P, who's in the chat room, Mike Chesney and Tristan. Don't go anywhere, folks. Stay tuned.
You must unite what is inside us.
We are TFR.
Welcome back, everyone, to hour number two of Down the Rabbit Hole, right here on www.truthfrequencyradio.com. Now, I'm your host, Kev Baker. Tonight, Popeye is away on a road trip, and I am joined by Mr. Christopher Everard from the Enigma channel, enigmatv.com, Joe Joseph from the Freedom Link, right here on Truth Frequency Radio Network. We've got Johnny Whistles, and he's from the Kev Baker Show, and me, Kev Baker, and finally, last but not least, and the man I'm going to go to first, Mr. Max Egan from thecrowhouse.com. Now, Max, you were rudely interrupted by Skype. We'll just say it was Skype before the break, and we were going over weaponized people. Let's pick it up from there, Max.
Yeah, as I was saying, you put these massive amounts of migrants into small villages. As I said, there's one village of 24 people. It's got a whole castle full of migrants in the village there with them. You've got another village of 124 that's been asked to take on 750 migrants. When you do this and you leave them there and they become bored and they don't really know what's going on, this creates a very dangerous situation. When we see the march of migrants across Europe, you had all these migrants come into Europe and basically be left there standing on the dock. And you've got to understand, these are people, even if they're not Syrians, even if they've stolen passports or whatever to get in, they're people who come from war zones and from very, very downtrodden countries, people who have had an incredibly hard life, who have been told to come here to have a better life. So then you leave them sitting on the dock there for a month, and of course they're just going to say, well, let's go to Germany. And they're going to walk across Europe the way they did. And then you stage a terror attack, and suddenly all of these people become a means of fear. You know, you've got a village here of 124 people that's got 750 migrants living in the village with them now, and suddenly you stage a terror attack in that country or in Europe, and suddenly all the people in this village are now living in fear of the migrants who are in their village, who may all be innocent people. But just that fact alone weaponizes these people against the psyche of the natural inhabitants of the area. You see what I'm saying? So they all become tools of this whole globalist agenda. And this creates, sows the seeds and creates an environment where you can have civil war, you can have martial law erupt at any moment, because the people will demand martial law to keep them safe from these terrible migrants that have overrun their country, and it's all been done by design.
Isn't that interesting, Max? And we see it here in the United States big time, you know, because us Americans, you know, that's what we are. We live in America, and in America, yeah. we don't like Muslims in America. You see, so that's the narrative that's being pushed right now. Even though Islam has nothing to do with it.
Islam has nothing to do with any of this. And the unfortunate part about that as well is that the American military machine is a big part of the problem, a big part of what's funneling all these weapons into the Middle East. You can look at who controls that. You'll find they're all dual Israeli citizens. And again, this isn't blaming the Jews. Israel's controlled by the same banking cartel that controls everything else, you know. But you've got to have these dual citizens in there in order to get this greater Israel project happening. But you've got to really look at this. And there's a bigger picture to all of it. There really is, you know. It's not anything like what we think it is. And the problem with America is that when they look at this, there's a very Amerocentric way of looking at it. They think it's an American problem. It's not. It's a global problem. America is being puppeteered by global banking cartels. And unfortunately, when the people look at the problems they've got within their country, their solution is to lock their borders and to do all this stuff and to be American and to secure America. But it's a global thing. It's a global thing. You can't really have a centralized way of looking at it because it's not really about that. It's a global beast, and it's not really America that's doing this at all. America is being puppeteered as much as anybody else in this.
You know what I find very interesting, Chris, is the fact that here in America, we've got it's now become a tradition. Whereas if you're a presidential candidate, you have to go to Jerusalem, to the Wailing
Wall. Oh, yeah.
With your yarmulke. And yes. You have to go and pray before the Wailing Wall, even though that wall has absolutely nothing to do with the temple itself.
That's right. That's absolutely right. We've just had Boris Johnson, who is simultaneously a member of parliament and the mayor of London, two very high-paid jobs, which he's doing simultaneously, but hey-ho, he's out at the Wailing Wall. And, I have to say that in the British Parliament, we have nearly 100 pro-Israeli politicians and civil servants and lords who are either directly Jewish themselves, or they come from a family with a Hebrew background. And I want to say something very, very important before I just move on to the background with the social engineering and the atomic bombs that the French did on Algeria. And that is that we are dealing with a Zivite situation. And this is something that has not really been covered. Many researchers don't really know about Shabbatai, who was the evil messiah, if you like, who was crowned as king of the Jews in the year 1666. We have an international global movement of Zivites, and they are loyal to Sabbatai Zevi. And they started off as being, normal, everyday Jewish people. And what happened is that they started preaching a dualistic, weird, inverted Judaism, a kind of Gnosticism where Satan all of a sudden became the good guy, the religious god, the god of creation. He was the bad guy. All of the traditional Jewish fasting days became feast days. Everything that was forbidden under Halakha, which is the Jewish law, all of a sudden was acceptable.
Yeah, imagine
the Ten
that.
Commandments were turned on their head. Can you imagine? Thou shalt not kill. Oh, killing is okay.
Well, the actual Hebrew translation to that is thou shalt not commit murder. That's the actual translation.
Yeah.
Because there are times where righteous anger, where, you've seen it in the Bible, right?
But the thing is that the Zevite movement,
they totally hijacked it, man.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But the Zivayat movement came to the attention of the Turkish authorities because Sabatai, his hometown was İzmir or Smyrna in Turkey, which is, by the way, the place, the port, which is 8 miles from the Greek island of Lesbos. And that's where a huge number of migrants are coming in. They're swimming across the 8 miles, or they're going in little tiny dinghies. And Smyrna, or İzmir, was the hometown of Sabbatai Zivi. And he started having orgies. He started promoting incest. And he had an international Jewish following that included the Sephardic Jews in Spain, the Ashkenazis, the Hasidic Jews. I mean, he had such a massive impact on Judaism. Wow. And he obviously was gathering a huge following because he was saying, you know, open sex and group sex and you can do what you want. And he was overturning all of the restrictions on their heads. And it was a great kind of sexual revolution within the Jewish world. And he came to the attention of the Turkish authorities, obviously the Ottoman authorities. They're Islamic, and they said, hey, you know, you're having all of these group orgies and everything. We want to be tolerant. We want to be friendly with the Jewish community. But, you know, now you're saying that incest is okay, and you're even saying that you've had sex with your own daughter, and that's no good. So he was put on a kind of court hearing with the chief sultan, and the sultan said, look, you know, we don't want to make waves because, you know, we've lived, you know, more or less in harmony with the Hebrew community, but you, sir, you're going to have to convert to be a Muslim, and you're going to have to tell everyone that everything that you've been saying, overturning all of the traditions in the Hebrew laws, has got to finish, because you've got a rabble of thousands, tens of thousands of people, and they're making hell. And if you don't become a Muslim, we're going to chop your head off. So he obviously became a Muslim that day. And what happened is that tens of thousands of the Zivite followers who had, you know, started pillaging and raping and incest and thievery and everything, all converted to Islam. They were Islamic on the exterior, and they started going to the mosques, and during the day, they were respecting all of the Muslim festivals, the Hajj, and all of the normal feast days, and showing modesty and this type of thing. But at night, they stuck to their original Zivite, Gnostic, kind of orgy-orientated kind of sex rituals and incest. When Sabbatai, he died, a guy called Nathan of Gaza took over the entire movement. And he led that movement. And then after Nathan of Gaza, a guy called Jacob Frank, another Jewish guy, he took over the helm of the Zivites. Now, the tens of thousands of Zivites who had converted to Islam in Turkey, they were known as the Donma, and the Turkish government today is dominated by Donmas. This is a very important thing. These people are next to, in the kind of, you know, ladder of secret societies, these are kind of Luciferians. They really believe that the God of creation is the bad guy and Satan is the good guy, secretly. On the outside, they're Muslims. If you remember, just a couple of years ago, just wind back the clock, there was a big news story of a Turkish minister being caught on CCTV in the Turkish parliament looking at hardcore pornography on his mobile phone during a debate.
Okay, Chris, just hang on just there, because some of the listeners in the chat room are saying we might be a little distorted, so I'm just going to reset. Okay, and that is us back, folks. I hope that cleared up any audio issues, because I don't want any of this information lost at all. Back to you, Chris.
Okay, so the Zevites, they became the Donma in Turkey. And then, 100 years after the death of Sabbatai Zevi, the entire international organization gets taken over by Jacob Frank, who is Jewish. Now, he converts, but he doesn't convert to Islam. He's a Jewish guy, and he converts to Catholicism. And he takes tens of thousands of these, people who believe in incest, they believe in murder. They believe that murdering non-Zevite, non-Jewish people is okay. I mean, these people are really very, very bad. And a lot of the rabbis were very, you know, they criticized the entire Frankist movement. The Zevites became the Frankists. He converted to Catholicism, and he was a baron. This guy was wealthy. He had a private army in Offenbach in Germany of 26,000 people on his payroll. Can you imagine meeting that salary bill? And this is in the 1700s. He had his own castle in Offenbach, and he had the greatest, richest people as friends and as guests at that castle. Who were they? Catherine the Great of Russia. She was a member of the Bavarian Illuminati. Baron Nigg, one of the founders of the Bavarian Illuminati. The fact is this, is that Jacob Frank, even though he was not a member of the Bavarian Illuminati officially, he was one of the biggest movers and shakers. He was a Satanist. He actually published weird poems promoting Luciferianism, incest, orgies, blood rituals, animal sacrifice, human sacrifice. And who do we see in the late 1700s? Right next door, Adam Weishaupt. And there we see the growth of the Rothschilds as well.
Yes.
Now we have a situation where there are some blogs saying that the House of Fawd in Saudi Arabia, some of those people are sympathetic to Frankism.
Really?
Yeah. And who else was influenced? The father of Karl Marx.
Oh, yes, of course.
Karl Marx was brought up in a Frankist household where the children were encouraged to have sex with each other, and also a very, very influential witch coven in North London in the 1960s called the Regency was influenced by Karl Marx, and that is a satanic coven. Where did Karl Marx live? He lived in Hampstead.
Uh-oh.
Coincidentally, I just want to throw this out here, too. You know, Karl Marx, of course, wasn't his real name.
His original name,
Moses Mordecai Marx Levy. I mean, if that doesn't tell you speak volumes, I don't know what does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they all had fake names. Leon Trotsky was called Bronstein.
Right.
He lived in New York, and he was very wealthy, and he had a chauffeur and a limo.
You can check if it's Bronstein or Bronstein, Joe.
But the really important thing I want to say about this is that there's been more than 45, I counted them up, there's been more than 45 senior ministers, prime ministers, and presidents of France since the Second World War who've all come from a Hebrew family background, and some of those are Zevites. Some of those people, on the face of it, look like respectable pillars of society, come from good Hebrew families, you know, well brought up, rich families, well educated, know their literature, know their music, teach their children well. They're very house proud, but some of those people are Zevites. And on the face of their policies, they always try and make their policies look as if they are in the interests of the people. What we can see in France, the real reality has now been blown open. You can't stage these false flag terror attacks without exposing a part of the plan. Okay,
exactly.
There is a risk aspect to all of these staged attacks. And what we've seen with the Friday the 13th attacks is that one of the main ringleaders is this guy called Mostafi. Let me just double-check his name.
They just killed? Is that the guy they just killed, Chris?
No. Yeah, his name is Mostafi. Okay. This is one of the guys whose finger was found amongst 80 bodies in the carnage of the cafe theater where the heavy metal band was playing.
Not to mention, that is record time, if you ask me, for all the forensics laboratory work go down. I mean, they did that shit quick. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, they found his finger. And from his finger, they said, this man is Mostafi. Okay, now, where does he come from? This guy is not Egyptian. He's not Syrian. He's not from Iran. He's not from Iraq. He is a Frenchman from Paris, from literally down the road from that cafe theater. He'd lived there all his life. He'd gone to a French school. I checked it all up this week. Okay, I could write a biography on this guy. He went to a French school. He grew up in a concrete tower block, not a big one. It was only five floors in this neighborhood called Cour-Corons. Okay. There's French people in that block. It's not all Muslim people. He was not born in Morocco. He was not born in Algeria. He was not born in Tunisia. He was born in Paris, brought up under the French system. He spoke French. Okay. Mostafi, that's his name. Now, what happened is this, is that he was reported by the Turkish authorities to the French Secret Service, right? How? Why did the Turkish authorities take all the time of sending a fax and an email to the French Secret Service? Because this guy had entered Turkey supposedly as a tourist, but there was no record of him leaving. And that put him on a list.
Ah, I gotcha.
Okay. The Turkish authorities, they could see that he'd entered Turkey. They couldn't see that he'd left Turkey. And if you enter Turkey, you get a stamp, because obviously it's not part of Europe, so they stamp your passport. As a tourist, you're allowed to go there for 4 weeks. When that 4 weeks is up, there's a list. Well, hang on a minute. These people came in, but they haven't left. Where are they? Now, this guy was reported by the Turkish authorities a year ago, and they said, this man is suspicious because he's obviously left Turkey, but he didn't leave through any official route, or he had alternative fake ID, which he used when he left.
Oh, man.
Now, what came out on Tuesday, remember, Friday the 13th, the massacre happened. On the following Tuesday, we then find out they found his finger. They identified his finger. They did that within hours of the massacre. Oh, and we find out officially through Le Monde, which is one of the big French newspapers, Mostafi had been arrested 8 times by the French police and released 8 times. And he was living in this ghetto, Cour-Corons. Most of the people there were actually Algerians. Why were the Algerians there? Why are there millions of Algerians in France when, if you look at the map, Algeria is this enormous country? Why? Because Algeria was a French colony, and the French government in 1916, 1961 had exploded 4 atomic bombs in Algeria. They blew up an entire mountain range. One of the bombs was four times the strength of the Hiroshima bomb. They even had a postage stamp commemorating these atomic blasts, so-called tests. I mean, if you blow up one bomb, you know it works, yeah? And they did about four of them. They irradiated this enormous area of Algeria, set off mass panic. People could not believe what was going on with the French who'd taken over Algeria. And so the Algerians had a campaign of public unrest. Yes, the Algerians, supposedly, I think it's true, they did plant a small bomb in a couple of bars where French troops were stationed from the French Foreign Legion. This is back in the 1960s, and they had to force the French out of Algeria and declare themselves independent. But damage had been done. Millions of square acres of Algeria was contaminated really bad. Remember, just one bomb was four times the strength of Hiroshima.
Yeah.
It irradiated the Algerian banana market. Okay. I mean, you know, that's a major, major crop. All right. Yeah. In Algeria. Okay. So what happened? Mass exodus across the Mediterranean. They all flooded into Marseille. And the French welcomed them at first. They welcomed them. This is a very important lesson for refugees who are listening to the show. They were welcomed. They were given, you know, a little bit of a helping hand with benefits. And then they were placed in these concrete tower block ghettos. Lille, Marseille, Paris, Amiens, spread out strategically like time bombs. The French government had created an Algerian, Tunisian, Moroccan, socially engineered time bomb. And it blew up in 2005, and now it's blown up again.
I want to throw this out for you. So the most powerful first test for an atomic bomb was France in Algeria, like Chris said, as a matter of fact. America's first test bomb was called Trinity. It was 20 kilotons. Soviets was RDS-1, 22 kilotons. This one was 70 kilotons.
Yeah,
70 kilotons.
Yeah.
It was called Blue Jeroba, or Jerba, Jerboa.
Yeah, it means
Blue
rat. Jeroba.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, I have to explain this to you guys. There is an unregistered nation of millions of people in the northern Sahara that does not have borders. Wow. It stretches all the way from Morocco all the way into Israel.
We're going to break. We'll be right back, man. Okay.
Real people, real radio.
Initiating the truth frequency.
Welcome back, everyone, to what is unfortunately the very last segment of the show. I'm your host tonight, Kev Baker. I'm joined by a fellow host on the network, Johnny Whistles, and another fellow host on the network, Joe Joseph, and another fellow host, Mr. Christopher Everard, and finally, Mr. Max Egan from all the way down under. And we are getting into all things Paris attack related. What a show, guys. If you're just tuning in, please, please, please head over to the archives and catch this, because this is must-hear information. And what we're going to do now is we're going to get Chris to round off what he was telling us there, and then we're going to get Max to give us the solution. Because we've laid out all of these problems tonight, and there has to be a way out. And I personally feel Max has it. So, Chris, back to you.
Yeah, I just want to finish off by saying that Mustafi, the guy that was identified by his finger amongst all of the bodies laying on the ground, he was one of the ringleaders, and he was a Frenchman. And Mustafi had already been alerted. There was an alert on his name provided by the Turkish authorities to the French police 1 year ago. Now, the Turkish authorities didn't get a reply to their email where they said, you've got to watch this guy because he must have left Turkey either surreptitiously or using fake ID. Mustafi had been arrested by the French police 8 times between 2004 and 2010. In October 2014, the French authorities do contact the Turkish authorities with a request for information on 4 suspected terrorists. And in the Turkish Times, the Turkish leader of the Turkish Immigration Authority said, "Oh, it's, you know, must be like Mustafa must be on that list of 4 people," and he was not. The French police were asking the Turkish authorities to furnish them with information about 4 other people. Now, he'd been arrested and released 8 times over, and then he was free and he was traveling around, probably using fake ID, and he probably went into Turkey. I don't know, maybe he went into Syria. But, you know, the point I'm making is that the French authorities are as guilty as hell, okay, because they had forewarning that this guy was moving around across international borders suspiciously, okay? Secondly, the French police believed that the guy that they killed, this is the other ringleader, that they killed in Saint-Denis in this kind of Vietnam kind of battle that took place, they even told the BBC, this is the French authorities, that, oh, no, this guy's in Syria. No, he wasn't. He was in Paris. Okay? And the other reason why the French authorities have got blood on their hands is because President Hollande paid $3.5 million to Boko Haram, and he also paid something like $34 million to Al-Qaeda for the return of 4 nuclear industry workers in Nigeria in 2013. And all I want to say to round up is that now Angela Merkel is saying that she's going to fast track Turkey's membership to the European Union. Turkey has got borders with Syria and borders with Iraq. And I published a satellite image of the border between Syria and Turkey. Do you know, guys, at that border point, there are tens of thousands of abandoned cars which are owned by Syrian people.
Photos. Yeah. Wow. They just left. I mean, that's the desperation of it, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah. And that will then now, because of Angela Merkel, that will become the border to Europe with its open borders, multicultural policy, where they can just jump on the terrorist express train and end up in Dublin or Manchester or Edinburgh. You know, they can end up in Stockholm. They can end up in Oslo. That's the plan. And I believe that this is creating a smokescreen. This incredible biblical exodus, this massive influx, there's been 667,000 official refugee entries into Britain in 18 months.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, in 18 months, okay? They say, oh, well, there's 300,000 people that have left Britain. You know, they're going over to live on continental Europe. Well, I dispute that, okay? Essentially, this biblical mass kind of movement of people, they're being baited by saying that there's quotas. Every single European country's got to do its part. There's a woman in Sweden called Barbara Lerner-Specter. She's a leader in the Jewish community in Sweden. She's saying, well, you know, Europe can't survive. Europe can't survive unless we have all of these people. You know, European societies are not going to be these monolithic ancient cultures which we're all used to. Multiculturalism is going to change, and Jewish people are going to be at the head of that. and Jewish people are going to be hated because we've pushed that multiculturalism through. What they're doing is they're creating a smokescreen of refugees, because within that tidal wave of refugees, there are Trojan horse sleeper assassins which have been trained by the intelligence communities. And this is going to be the IRA, it's going to be urban warfare, and it's going to be on the streets of all of Europe.
Absolutely, and this is the weaponization of people. Now, this Spectre character, she is a very good segue to come to Max. Because, Max, we've been talking about all of this tonight, and it is all orchestrated, funded, ran by the Cabal. Now, you were speaking to me a few weeks ago, just after that vicious attack you suffered, and you were speaking about a way out of this, and it was absolutely amazing to listen to you. How do we get out of this, Max? Who do we go after?
Well, the thing is, we've got to go after the whole thing. That's the problem, you know. We're given compartmentalized approaches all the time in our response to what's happening. You know, we need a full spectrum response. That's what I've started Full Circle Project for, and there's a lot of people getting involved in that. If anybody out there hasn't heard of the Full Circle Project, what this is about is linking people up. Because everywhere I go, I meet people and they say, look, I want to get active, but I don't have a support group around me. So you can log on to Full Circle website. You can do a search, find other people who are part of the project, and you can start an action group, find a support group in your area so you can push things forward. But ultimately, the way I look at it, I mean, there's a criminal cabal that is running this earth, and it's a global cabal. We've got to admit that. And it's creating all sorts of problems in our societies. You know, the wars, everything that's happening in Europe, you know, you're trying to address this whole migrant problem. It's happening because of legislation the governments have put in place, which is allowing it to happen. You know, the wars are happening because of legislation. You know, the coal seam gas mining is happening because of legislation. All the problems that we're facing are all the result of legislation. And you've got people trying to address all of these different problems, which are in fact symptoms of the wider problem, which is the abusive relationship that we have developed with all of our governments. But again, as I was saying before, we tend to have a compartmentalized approach. We'll try to go down the avenue that's provided for us to deal with whatever corporate problem it is. And it's the same as when we look at it on a national level. I was saying before, people are very Amerocentric in the way they look at the problems of the United States. People are the same here in Australia. They're the same in France, same in all countries. They see it as a national problem when really it's a global problem. The problem is we have a criminal cabal which runs this entire system. And it's all linked up with the governments and the corporations and the banksters and the whole thing. It's all the one organism. The government's simply the facade that is in the front of the whole thing, which hides the mechanism which lays behind it. We get stuck in all these debates over what that may be, and they turn into arguments. Someone will say, oh, it's the Jews. Oh, it's the Jesuits. Oh, it's aliens. Oh, it's reptilians. Oh, it's this, it's that. It just goes on and on and on. Nobody really knows for sure, but what I'm saying is that the mechanism is government itself and the corporate system and the banking system. So we need a means to deal with that. So right in the center stage of the earth is Palestine and Gaza Strip. And I talk about this all the time, and people say, oh, Max is distracting us. He's saying the Jews are the problem. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that all the problems we face are the result of legislation, because people believe legislation is real. They believe this whole fictional paper-based legal system they've got is actually real. So we can use that belief to our advantage, because there was also laws that were written at the close of World War II, things such as the Geneva Convention. And there's a section in the Geneva Convention, Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which deems collective punishment to be a war crime. This is based on what happened in the Warsaw Ghetto, what we're told happened in the Warsaw Ghetto. Whether it did or not, I don't know. I'm not even going to go there. But, you know, that law exists. So if any of their papers are real, any of their legislation is real, well, this paper must be real too. This law must be seen to be worthy of some respect. And this legislation says that collective punishment is a war crime. And what we have is governments all around the world who are enacting all of the problems that I just outlined all through legislation. And you'll find that every single one of these politicians supports the state of Israel, which is carrying out the war crime of collective punishment. And that's Gaza Strip. This is collective punishment, breach of Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And if the people of the world were to call this out, we could have all of these people pulled from office and held accountable immediately, have them all arrested. And people will say, well, how can we do that? How can we have them arrested? You know, well, if we had a huge public outcry, we could. Because if all the people in the world believe this legal system is real, those that are hiding behind the mechanism of government, if they see a huge, huge public outcry for this issue, then they're going to have to pretend the legal system is real as well. And we can arrest the entire cabal because every single one of them are war criminals. Now, how can any legislation these people write be valid if it can be shown that these people are supporting war crimes under their own law, which it can and they are? So we can use that to our advantage if we were to call this out. You know, the problem is people think that by supporting Gaza and Palestine, you're supporting the Muslims against Israel or whatever it is. You know, they got all these programs running. It's not nothing to do with Jews against Muslims or with Palestinians against Israelis. What it's about is the war crime of collective punishment. You've got Gaza Strip, 1.8 million people, average age of 17, for God's sake. It's a population of children being held in collective punishment, being supported by all of our governments. And every politician in the United States, like you said, they've got to go to the Wailing Wall and do all this stuff. Every politician in the United States has to sign an agreement to support Israel before they will get any campaign funding. That is treason. That is treason in itself, just that very action. Swearing allegiance to a foreign power before you are able to run for office, and this is allowed because the people don't call it out? What is going on here? You know, all of these people are supporting a war crime. If we can get this whole stigma of Muslim against Jew and Palestinian against Israeli out of our mind and call this out for what it is, I believe it gives us the ability to call out every single government on this planet. You know, how can I show your government any support at all if it can be shown that you're supporting war crimes? And it can be shown that you are. So I have a moral and legal dilemma going on here because I'm in a situation where I have a moral duty and a legal duty not to support your government because you're supporting war crimes. You know what I'm saying? You need to show me that you're not supporting war crimes because I can show you that you are. And if you are, then how is anything you're doing valid? How are any of these wars valid? How is anything that you have done since the existence of Gaza Strip, since that wall went up in 2007, how is anything, any politician that supported this or any corporation or any banking cartel that has supported this, how are any of these people doing anything legal? And how is the media doing anything legal? That's our biggest problem, really, is the media. You know, these people are so guilty of war crimes. These people have promoted and sold this whole thing to the public. And propaganda of war is the most serious war crime you can commit because without propaganda of war, none of the other stuff can happen. If it isn't sold to the public and packaged in the right way, none of the genocide, none of the use of banned weapons, none of the ethnic cleansing, none of this can happen without the media supporting it all. So, you know, we're not going to get any response by going down the legal avenues that they give us if we continue to adopt a compartmentalized approach. We've got to go for the throat. And I believe that if we call out the war crime, we call out the whole system. And if people can simply open their hearts, then I believe they can do it. You know, that's all it would take really is for people to open their hearts. There are children that are suffering and all of these wars and all this mayhem, this has all been conducted by war criminals, open war criminals, blatant war criminals, and we have the ability to call it out. And that's what I think Gaza is providing us the opportunity to do. And we've got about 4 years to do it. Gaza will last another 4 or 5 years and then it will be gone because it's just not livable anymore. It's not inhabitable anymore.
And as far as support is concerned, that's dwindling, isn't it? The people there are really suffering, Max. Personally,
they're suffering terribly, the people in Gaza. And support for Israel is dwindling, but no one really knows how to stop the flow of support that Israel's getting from all of our governments. The way to do it is to call it out, call out these governments for war crimes, call out, you know, President Hollande, he's supporting the state of Israel, so therefore he's supporting war crimes. He's in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. How can anything he's enacting be legal? How can any of it be seen as valid if he can be shown to be a war criminal? He is. Same with Barack Obama. How can anything he has enacted, United States government has enacted since 2007, how can any of these laws or executive orders or any of it seem to be valid when they've been enacted by people who are openly supporting a breach of Article 33? You know, this Geneva Convention was put in place for a reason. The UN was created in order to prevent war. And we've had more wars since the UN was created than we had in Earth's entire recorded history prior to that point. That's got to say something to people.
Police action. Police action. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's not really a war, Max. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah,
I exactly. think. I
well,
think
in Gaza, it's not a war. In Gaza, it's not a war. In Gaza, it's an army fighting against children. It takes two armies to have a war. It takes two countries to have a war. Israel and Palestine is the one country, and it's an army fighting against children. This is not a war. This is genocide and weapons testing. That's all it is.
I think Netanyahu must be actually rubbing his hands just now by the fact that the stabbings that's going on over there, because what people don't get to see is what happens in Gaza. You only get to see what happens in Israel. Do you know what I mean? Nobody ever sees the other side, that just what has actually prompted
what has led
this
to
guy
this?
To do this. Yeah.
Well, what has led to this? But a lot of them are fake. I mean, you'll see there was a stabbing recently. A girl pulled a knife. They shot her 10 times. They shot her, 18-year-old girl. You look at the video footage, there's about 10 soldiers there. And they're all standing around. She's about 15 feet from any of them. They're all in armored clothes, you know, Kevlar, and they're all fully done up in military gear. And they're telling us to believe that this woman pulled a knife and attempted to stab a soldier at a checkpoint. We're also told there was an attack. Two Palestinians shot up a bus station with a gun and a knife. Well, for a start, you've got to go through one of those checkpoints where they make you actually take your pants off. If you're a Palestinian, to get through the checkpoint, they humiliate these people dreadfully. Mm-hmm. You got to go through a checkpoint where you've got to virtually strip half naked. Then you've got to go through a metal detector to even get into the bus station. So how in hell did they get the knife and the gun in there to begin with? And when we see the video footage, we don't see any injured Israelis. All we see are two dead Palestinians. There's also the gun and knife attack on the bus, which I have video footage proving that this thing was fake. It didn't even happen. They just dragged a bus in there. They got all the passengers off. They shot it up themselves and then likely brought a couple of Palestinian prisoners in there and shot them and called knife attack and used it as an excuse to lock down West Bank. Most of these attacks don't even happen.
Yeah.
And the Palestinian people are brutalized to a degree you would not believe. There was a young woman shot at a checkpoint the other day for no reason. No reason whatsoever. You know, they just brutalize, terrorize these people. They brutalize and terrorize their children. They threaten them. It's absolutely disgraceful, and it's all funded by our governments, and we have to call it out. We have to call a stop to it. The thing is, if we call this out, this humanitarian crisis has been funded by our governments, this open war crime that is being funded by our governments, if we call this out globally, then we can call out the whole cabal and we can heal all of the other symptoms that have been created. And this isn't an attack against the Jews. It wouldn't matter if this was Japan doing this to Paraguay. It doesn't matter who's doing it. It's collective punishment. It's a war crime. They're all supporting it, and it's a tool we can use because people believe the law is real, you know?
I just want to say, I absolutely agree, Max, that Brian Eno and Roger Waters of Pink Floyd and the Pixies and Brian Adams, there's several big celebrities now which they agree 1,000% with you, Max.
Well, it's true. It's true.
You know, Nelson Mandela.
I'll just finish one thing. I put out a video, a 7-minute video called Save Gaza, Save the World, A Message to Humanity. Please go and look it up on YouTube and please share it. And I'm going to have it translated into Spanish soon as well, because this truly is a key that we can use to heal the world. Sorry for interrupting, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say that celebrities all gathered a big peace concert in London. You know, to actually protest apartheid in South Africa. And that concert put so much public pressure on the British government and on the South African government that basically, Nelson Mandela was released within months of that concert. It can be done. Roger Waters, you know, the Wall concerts, you know, if you have these people that speak out, it will improve. And I think Netanyahu, a Spanish judge, has just said that the convoy taking supplies and medical goods for the people in Palestine that was attacked, Netanyahu is now, if he steps foot on Spanish soil, is going to be arrested and he's going to be questioned by the Spanish authorities.
Yeah, that's so fantastic news.
Yeah, so there is, you know, there this awakening. I can really see it. I can really see it. These politicians are looking at what we're doing on social media. They're looking at the independent media, which quite frankly, you know, you look at the listening figures of some of the BBC stations. We've got the audience. The audience are reading our stuff. They're watching our stuff. They're listening to our stuff. And the mainstream media know that they've lost it. In actual fact, there's a crisis of funding. People are using ad blockers, and the newspapers don't know what to do about it. Nobody's reading the mainstream newspapers if the newspapers are forcing you to pay. And this awakening is happening. And I'd just like to add, I agree absolutely with what Max is saying, and I'd like to add that this entire Levant area used to be called the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And you've got these massive temples from the ancient world, mosques, Christian sites, Jewish sites. You know, these are United Nations World Heritage sites. And I think that the whole place needs to be demilitarized. It needs to be pedestrianized. All weapons need to be taken away. The IDF needs to be turned into a peace police tourist force. They need to get some new airports in there. They need to break down those borders. They need to turn the entire area into a World Heritage tourist site, because it's such a rich heritage there.
Well, it is. I mean, Gaza City is one of the oldest cities in the world. And something else people don't understand about the siege of Gaza is that the population of Gaza is 35% Christian. Okay? It's 35% Christian. I went to one building in Gaza Strip that is on the corner of a block. It's probably not there anymore. It's probably been bombed. But it was a church on one side and a mosque on the other. There was one door on the corner, and you walked in, and there was mats on the right-hand side, and there were pews on the left-hand side, and there were two altars where the Christians and the Muslims pray together in the one building. Okay? There is no animosity between these people. They get along fine. It's one of the oldest cities in the world, and a population of 35% Christians. So Israel is bombing Christians here, folks. If you come from a Christian nation, think about that.
I have to say, Max, that there's some very interesting footage that surfaced with an American journalist. I think it was the guy that made Supersize Me, Spurlock, his name is. And he went to Israel and he was, you know, making a vox pop thing, interviewing people on the streets, asking people about Christianity. And the animosity that was coming from people was really weird. I mean, they're saying, who is Jesus to you? They were saying, who is Jesus to you? And they were saying, he's nothing to me. Well, Jesus is the most famous Jewish historical legendary character. He was a Jew.
The thing is, he was a Jew, but he was born in Palestine, in Galilee. And the Jews fully believe that what Jesus did, what he did was against the Jewish faith. He betrayed the Jewish faith because he gave away Jewish secrets. He gave away Kabbalistic secrets, and that he deserved what he got, and that at the moment he is boiling in hot excrement in hell. That's what the Jewish faith believes. That's what they have absolutely no reverence for Jesus at all. So the Christians that are supporting Israel because they believe that it's the Christian thing to do, who don't understand what these people think of Christians, you know.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, guys, we are almost out of time. Now, you can check out Chris's work at enigmatv.com, and you can check out Max at thecrowhouse.com. And also, what's the other website, Max?
It's the Full Circle. It's the Full Circle website, which is fullcircleproject.net. And look, when I'm saying all that as well, you've got to understand that the whole thing's being puppeteered. The Jews aren't the problem. The people of Israel are programmed to do what they do. All these people are programmed to do what they do.
Yeah.
Same as the response we're seeing from the public over these French attacks. They're programmed to respond this way. So we've got to get rid of our judgment from people. We've got to get rid of our racial discrimination with people. We've got to start calling things out for what they are from a human perspective and using the legal system against itself while we still have the ability to do it.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you so much for your time. Now listen, everyone, stay tuned. Mike and Chris Stan are coming up after the break. And in a very special treat for tomorrow night's Freaky Friday, we're going to be having on Mr. Max Egan to talk all about that freaky woo subject, the Mandela Effect. Thoughts and prayers go to everyone who's oppressed and under the bombs of the Western cabal right now. This has been the Kev Baker Show and Down the Rabbit Hole, www.truthfrequencyradio.com.